Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're glad to have all of you with us after what I hope was a great weekend for everyone out there. If you're listening to us in real time this afternoon, many of you, especially in the Metro Atlanta area, are in a, as our news people have reported, a pretty high-risk area for some potentially very severe thunderstorms. So I hope you're kind of keeping your ear tuned to the weather, or if you're at home watching it on TV. But it looks like you could get pretty nasty out there, Jim Galloway.
Yeah, and we got a tarp on our roof right now.
Oh, gosh.
Had a tree come through just a couple days ago.
Oh, Jim.
And now we're going to cross our fingers.
All right. So Jim Galloway and his wife will be spending tonight at the Motel 6 down
We've got the pots out in the kitchen and all the towels that the cupboard holds out.
All right. They don't have to leave the light on for you. Heath Garrett, Republican strategist, is also with us. But before I move on, I should say, of course, Jim Galloway, who is my partner here on Mondays and Fridays and is the lead political writer for the AJC. He's in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays with his column and, of course, oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia as part of the MyAJC.com website. It's a long tree that you've got to follow to get there, Heath Garrett.
That's right, but I'm glad to be here with him anyway.
Yeah. Heath Garrett, a Republican strategist, and who is a regular on our Monday show, and we're really glad to have you here, Heath. And Michael Owens is with us this afternoon. He is the chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. So it's really great to have you here, Michael. And at some point in the show, your expertise, because you run a major cybersecurity company when you're not doing Democratic Party politics, and I suspect that you may have a lot to say about what happened with this story of Cambridge Analytica and the possibility that they took advantage of scraping some 50 million profiles off Facebook, perhaps in the interest of the Donald Trump presidential campaign. I look forward to your comments on that at some point during the show.
Great. Thanks. Happy to be here.
All right. Before we really get rolling, a couple of quick notes. First of all, I told you that we were going to start putting together information for you about our trip down to Macon. We are going to be there on April 12th. We're going to be on the campus at Mercer University, and we're going to do the show at 7 o'clock on Thursday night, April 12th. We don't have a site yet set up where you can get tickets, free tickets, where you can register for it, but our producer, Tom Faust, says within the next few days we'll be able to announce all the details. But we sure would love to have you come see us when we're down there. Jim, it's going to be fun to go to Macon.
Right. Yeah. And this will be in the evening, right?
It'll
be
7 o'clock
after work.
Yep. 7 o'clock on Thursday night for air and our regular time.
It worked out very well in Savannah. We packed the house.
300+ people. So Macon, you've got a goal, a target to shoot for. The other quick thing is you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. I said the other day that I am back to talking about Twitter. Because Michael Owens, among other people, said he'd been hearing from folks saying, why doesn't Nigut use the Twitter handle anymore? And Michael, you were right. So we're inviting people to tweet us. And as the tweets come in, as appropriate, if they're appropriate, we'll try to work them into the show. Okay, enough of all that. Heath Garrett, I'm going to start with you because you're the Republican at the table today. We've all been following this story about David Schaefer, State Senator David Schaefer, a candidate for lieutenant governor, and by most accounts, the leading candidate on the Republican side.
I think that's right.
For lieutenant governor. He has been accused by a longtime lobbyist at the General Assembly of not just one apparently incident, but a series of incidents in which she accuses him of inappropriate behavior, sexual behavior. And the AJC has tried to get access to, you know, whatever the state has, paperwork on this. They don't have to turn it over because, Jim, the General Assembly isn't subject to the open records laws.
How convenient. It exempted itself.
Yeah. But now we do have a development. Heath, the Senate has hired an attorney and not just any attorney, but a really strong attorney to look into this. Tell us what you know about this.
Well, a little bit we do know. I think the AJC has done a good job of reporting, but the Senate, they are exempt from open meetings, open records, but they do have a process by which they do investigate these types of things, and they have now appointed a pretty aggressive and, it means by reputation, tough Democratic-affiliated attorney from the city of Atlanta. He has a lot of background in investigations.
Penn Payne,
and has a strong legal reputation at being tough, has had some experience in these types of employment investigations. And even though we talk about it as sexual harassment, it is an employer-employee type relationship.
And she lists sexual and racial harassment as some of her specialties.
Exactly.
She actually was hired by the Atlanta Public School, or she was hired to investigate initially the cheating scandal at the Atlanta Public School. So she's got a pretty strong background. And Jim, this suggests that although Schaefer, of course, has vigorously denied this and said it's all politics and all an attempt to destroy his candidacy, hiring an investigator means this is not going away anytime soon, certainly not before the primary at the end of May.
No, and the personnel issue, the hiring of this particular attorney is to me a signal that they're taking it very seriously, which is going to require David Schaefer to take it seriously, and I'm sure he's going to be required to hire his own attorney.
Yeah. So, Michael, okay, so here's the skeptical side of a journalist watching this unfold. Penn Payne has apparently she's contributed some money, according to the AJC, to Democratic candidates. She tends to give to Democrats. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you could say, well, this is the state, the Republican-run state Senate, showing we're serious. We know she is very talented. We take this seriously. The other side of it could be you could have a little Trump situation going on here where if she finds that Schaefer has been guilty of these things, you can say it's all based on her bias as a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, you could. I mean, theoretically, you could look at it either way, right? You could look at the idea of that, or you could look at the fact that hiring a Democrat basically shows that they're actually serious about not being any collusion, to use another Trump-esque type word, right?
Yep.
The minute there's no collusion, and the Schaefer has said that he's completely innocent of all this, and it's just a political vendetta, and she's trying to get her 15 minutes, or the accuser is trying to get their 15 minutes of fame out of this. So it could be a way of saying, hey, we want to take we want to show that we're serious and make sure there's no collusion or anything going on, so whatever is found out, we could rely on this as being the truth.
Yeah, if there is a political motive at anywhere behind this accusation, I think it falls on the Republican side, not on the Democrat.
Yes.
The timing tells us that this is a primary campaign issue.
All right. Well, we're going to watch it move forward. Heath, how does this shake up the lieutenant governor's race?
Well, I think it obviously is the worst way you could start out a campaign with only a few weeks left until the primary. This clearly indicates that it's not going to be resolved in time for the May 22nd primary in the Republican primary. And the question is it something that's waiting there? Is there going to be a runoff? David Schaefer was clearly, by fundraising and by name recognition, the front runner in that race. This now throws that into jeopardy. The question is, can the other candidates, how you use an issue like this is very difficult. They can either overplay their hand, but there are two other candidates in that race, and the question is, can one or two of them—
Jeff Duncan and Rick Jafaris.
Yeah, that's right. And both seem to have their own bases and pockets, but neither has caught fire as the true alternative to David Schaefer, and so one of them is going to have to break out of that.
Yeah, I think at minimum, what we can say is that the chances of a runoff just have gone up
exponentially.
You know what? I hadn't thought about it, but the session ends a week from Thursday on March 29th, and that's another interesting time frame because the biggest headlines about this case so far are all hitting as we approach sine die, and that's the moment at which, given freed of the session, candidates who can start raising money again, I wonder if this is going to have an impact on the fundraising that Schaefer has to do starting on March 30th.
I think it absolutely does, right? I mean, I think right now, with legislators being barred from raising funds right now, everyone's kind of trying to line up and get their horses in the chute ready to go. And I just don't know how much Schaefer's horse is going to be able to come out, you know, now with people to donate money to him in the midst of this all out-and-out scandal.
All right. Well, we're going to watch this unfold and see where it leads. The other question about this, Jim, is despite this rather serious story, we have not seen any movement. And Political Insider had a column about this, a blog about this recently. We haven't seen any larger movement to kind of open the windows of transparency in terms of other harassment at the Gold Dome. It's interesting how immune Georgia's legislature seems to be from the Me Too movement, all still at this moment.
Well, and this is by design. I mean, this is we mentioned earlier. I mean, when you close the legislature away from the state's open records law, you protect them, and it's and the dynamic. Yes, the Me Too movement is out there, but in the Capitol, business is business, yeah. And you still have. I mean, we had Janelle Davis, my AJC colleagues, had a nice long piece, come out in which, you know, she talks to female lobbyist after female lobbyist, very few of whom want their names used because if shown in a bad light, well, then their bill tanks.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. All right. So we'll watch the David Schaefer story unfold in the weeks ahead. Let's, as long as we're talking about the 2018 election cycle, Jim, the two Stacys were at a Democratic forum. The Young Democrats brought them both in to talk. And, you know, you might think that in facing a group of Democratic voters that this might be a very kind of friendly audience, an audience that was on the sides of one or the other of the candidates. They both got, according to the reporting from your folks, they both kind of got grilled on different issues.
Oh yeah, that wouldn't surprise me because you've got a very large Stacey Abrams faction in the Democratic Party and a very large, maybe not quite as large, Stacey Evans faction, and each group of followers is going to make sure that they roast the other. So that part really wasn't a surprise.
Oh, okay.
The issues, of course, that's what's gonna heat up over the next 8 weeks or so.
All right. Yeah. So, Michael, one of the things that Abrams did at this forum was to address this question about her tax debt, $50-some thousand she owes to the IRS in deferred taxes, and her line on this, and I suspect we're gonna hear it. Throughout the primary, shocking, I'm human, she said, and went on to explain that she's owes the Internal Revenue in part because she was taking care of elderly parents and she was low on funds to pay the debt. How is this playing out there among Democrats?
I mean, I was at the Young Democrats convention over the weekend. I didn't get there until a little bit later in the evening, and I'm proud to say that Cobb County was a host sponsor this year, and Cobb County Democratic Committee was a platinum sponsor. I'll throw that out there. I'm like Jim. I'm not surprised at all that both candidates were grilled really hard. The Young Democrats are not a group to just stand by and kind of go with the status quo. They're really pushing the whole Democratic Party as a whole to move forward and ask the tough questions that need to be asked. So I'm happy for them for asking those tough questions. But it's also a primary season. It's when these questions should be asked and when these items that Republicans could later on hit either one of them with needs to be fleshed out now, needs to be discussed now. I think Stacey Abrams has made no bones about the fact that, you know, she wasn't born wealthy. And she's worked very hard to get to where she is. So the idea of being in debt is not it has no direct reflection on her as a person and where she can go. It simply means that where she started out from may not be where everyone else did. And in this day and age, credit card debt and student loan interest debt is commonplace. So I don't necessarily look at that as a defining issue that Democrats are going to make when they go to the polls.
Heath?
You know, I think this issue has changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years, particularly after the Great Recession, when so many people ended up in some type of debt. If she's able to reframe this as I'm human and this is debt, then she's going to survive the Democratic primary and it'll come back up in the general election. But if Stacey Evans is able to define this as you have an obligation to the U.S. federal government, the IRS, and frames this as this puts her in jeopardy of not only not being able to serve out fully and faithfully as the next governor of the state because of legal issues, right, and combined with other, and there are a couple of these suggestions, other ethical type questions about where her income is coming from through her different companies, then it goes back to the classic ethical type of issue of, or if you're not willing to pay your debts, right, to the federal government, then how can you govern a $25 billion governmental enterprise?
Yeah, Bill, while I was waiting for the roofers this morning, I was trying to research the next column, and I went back to 2008 and the debate over former Congressman Nathan Deal's finances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this was an October story, I believe. I'd have to go back and check that. But he and his wife paid maybe $2,000 in federal taxes in a couple years leading up to that because they had these tremendous losses on the business side over what we call the Wilder Outdoor venture that his daughter and son-in-law had ventured out up in North Georgia, and it was just a bust. And there was a quote from our friend Brian Robinson saying that this is a man who tried to do his best by his family, which sounds very, very much like what Stacey Abrams says. This is not, you know, this is, I think Keith's right. This the financial difficulty since the Great Recession, people have been a lot more forgiving. But if you're on the Democratic side, that's not really that's not what this argument is about. If Stacey Abrams wins the nomination in May and becomes the Democratic nominee for governor, she wants to be the first African-American woman governor of Georgia in the nation. It's going to be a very racially polarized race. And in those kind of contests, people grab on to secondary excuses to justify their primary opposition. And that you've got a whole lot of Democrats who are afraid that that's what this would offer.
Michael, Jim is being very careful in the language he's using. But what he's suggesting, I believe, is that because if Abrams is a nominee, an African-American nominee, that the fact that she is deep in debt will, serve people to vote against, people who don't want an African-American governor to vote against her because of her debt. And maybe there's another thing that you haven't quite said, and I'll throw this out to you, is whether there's any suggestion there that that people who are bigoted believe that African Americans can't handle their money the way white people can.
Dance around it all you may. It is a fact of the matter. And people, unfortunately, today still think this way. I think back to the past election that Douglas County had with the county commission chair out there, and his blatant statements have said, hey, look, this is why we can't have black people in charge, right? They don't know how to handle money. They ruin us and they throw us in debt. So it's not unfounded. And unfortunately, yes, people do think that way. But on the flip side, you could go into Stacey Evans' story and talks about how she grew up very poor in Mississippi with very little money to go on.
Stacey Abrams,
I'm sorry. Very poor, and to go on to become, you know, an Ivy League graduate and to lead the House and to, you know, all these fantastic things that she's done would actually lean in direct contrast to that statement that somehow, because of the color of your skin, you are inherently financially unsavvy, right? The lady's a novelist. She's done many fantastic things. So unfortunately, people will tie that there. But Stacey Abrams and Evans both have this story of, you know, an impoverished background and where they come from to go on to do things that they've done.
Well, Heath, if it gets that ugly, whether it's overt or quiet whispering, it doesn't do any of us any good. I mean, that's scary. You know, Sam Olens, when he ran his first and second statewide races for attorney general, never wanted to talk about it because it didn't serve him well publicly to talk about it. But especially in South Georgia, the whisper campaign about whether we could have a Jewish state constitutional officer, especially an attorney general, was pretty strong. I hate to think that there's the possibility that we head that direction in this.
No, I think that's right. I helped run Sam's campaigns, and having the first statewide nominated Republican who was Jewish and then the first statewide constitutional officer in the South. I saw some of that. I think that we as political scientists tend to overstate that sometimes when our person wins or loses based on ethnicity or race. I think what's interesting in Georgia is, and I agree with Jim and Michael to a certain extent, except that it's not the general election that I'm watching this. This is the most racially polarized Democratic primary in the South in years, and it's playing out in the Democratic primary amongst white liberals who profess to be racially progressive, yet are whispering behind closed doors that they don't like the racial tinge of this. And I think that it is going to be both in the primary and the general election that we need to watch this, and it could play out positively or negatively. I do think politically she's got a great chance to turn that story, and having it vetted now is better for her in this regard. Sure. And then I think Georgia is in a better place in the general election to deal with this racially, at least tinged, and we're not as bad as we would have been 20 or 30 years ago. Sam proved that in the Republican primary to a certain extent. I think there's some other indicators out there, but you're right. How both parties handle this will determine the future of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in the next decade. Yeah.
You know, did you want to weigh in on that?
I was going to say, I think he touched on something very important to talk about from the very beginning with this fantastic primary shape up between, these Stacys, right, can be sliced down many ways. And we knew it was going to be this much of a big challenge because you do have, obviously, a black woman and a white woman, but you also have, someone who's seen primarily in some sense more progressive. Who's progressive and who's the moderate? Who's this person that's going to speak to the Ringgold, Georgia, right, versus maybe Metro Atlanta? So you slice and dice this so many ways, but one of those key areas is going to be the white liberal female organizations and groups and those people who really gone out and got activated. I know that's flooded the Democratic Party and many of the other parties. Where are they going to stand along these lines? Is it going to be a feel-good story about being able to vote for someone who's black because they can to show that they're not racially tinged? Or is it going to be sticking closer to home with tried and true, someone they may be more comfortable with in other social settings? It is one of the most interesting primaries that I've ever been a part of, and to see this shake out is just going to be incredible.
All right, we got a lot more to talk about on the show today. We need to get a break out of the way. When we come back, we will continue going down a list of a lot of big news that happened over this past weekend. This is Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported the station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. You know, I forgot to remind everybody we're on Facebook Live right now. If you want to watch us on the air, that's Michael and me, and Heath is over there, and Jim Galloway. Go to the GPB News Facebook page, and you can watch what's going on in the radio studio as the show unfolds. And, of course, we would love to have you start tweeting us at PoliticsGPB.
Seems like a zero-sum game, doesn't it? If you emphasize Twitter, you forget about Facebook.
I know. you're right. It's true. Jim, you ask, a great question today. And let me set it up. The question is, it's the headline of the Political Insider Jolt. Would an anti-Trump campaign be viable in Georgia? Let me set this up just a little bit, if I may. It's interesting. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll was just released, and it showed that Trump's approval numbers are back up. He's up 43%, according to an NBC Wall Street Journal. But when it comes to congressional races across the country, people who were polled preferred Democratic candidates in congressional races to Republican candidates by 10%. And the Republicans are losing support among white voters, down 3 points, GOP districts down 6 points, suburbanites down 7, and white-collar workers, the heart of Trump's base, down 9 points. With all that in mind, would an anti-Trump campaign be viable in Georgia?
And it's a good question, and I think we might be presented with an answer to it. Especially if Donald Trump keeps going after the Robert Mueller investigation, and God forbid if he goes in and fires Mueller or tries to halt the Russian investigation. Number one, a lot can happen between now and May 22nd. So you've got that going, but you've also got, at least in Georgia, a couple good races, possibly the 6th District congressional race.
Karen Handel, the incumbent.
Versus 4 Democrats. And the 7th District congressional race, Rob Woodall, the Republican incumbent, versus 6 Democrats. You know, in each of those races, there are people going to be desperate for attention. And at least in the 7th District, they're not going to have a lot of money. Probably not any. So how do you get that attention? How do you issue a shorthand message to Democratic voters? Well, yeah. You go after Donald Trump.
Yeah, except Heath, it you go after Donald Trump, but with his numbers seeming to be, it's a contradiction. His numbers are moving up while Congresses are moving even further down the Republican side.
I think this poll is very interesting. For a little context, though, in context, over the last 30 to 40 years, Democrats have on average maintained a 10-point gap in lead over who the American people want to run Congress. Yet during those periods of time, we've had Republican majorities for a large percentage of the last 2 decades now. Part of that's redistricting. Part of that is the way that we do the polling. And part of that's the way that independents don't get counted in on all of this. So, again, a nationwide trend is kind of like, Mrs. Clinton won the popular vote but didn't win the Electoral College. So, somewhat true in these House races in particular. It's hard to extrapolate from that. However, there's a lot in here that should make Republicans in my business pay attention. Any Republican who thinks that either this November or 2020 is going to be a slam dunk for either Donald Trump or the Republicans to maintain the majority are kidding themselves and need to pay attention to some of these trends.
Michael, let me set this up. The Wall Street Journal, NBC folks say that the Republican districts that could be trouble for Trump include suburban urban areas around Atlanta, the 6th and 7th districts, Detroit, Cleveland, Minneapolis, St. Paul, New York City, even Omaha, Nebraska. These are all places, they point out, with voting populations that look an awful lot like that Pennsylvania 18th.
Yeah, I think... Heath touched on a few of those things and how, I'll give you a simple answer, is through gerrymandering, right? When you can slice and dice populations to be able to maximize the Republican vote or the Democratic vote if it was the other way, but you can, it's a scientifically proven method to be able to gain representative seats through manipulating the districts and where people live. So I think that's an easy answer for this conundrum that you're looking at these polling numbers. But outside of that, I think as Trump's numbers increases, I don't know that the actual popular support on the ground is increasing. I remember last year in the 6th congressional district race for the John Ossoff election, many people still say the reason he lost that election was because he didn't go after Trump. He didn't keep going after him, even after Donald Trump came down and stumped for Karen Handel in the runoff, that he lightened up. He didn't go after her. So to Jim's point, I think it's going to be too attractive for Democrats not to actually, say, hey, here's some low-hanging fruit. What do we say? Donald Trump's bad. We don't want him in office. You didn't want him in office. Now you have a chance to do something about it.
So, Jim, the Republicans they believed when they passed their tax cuts, which have had, so far, an impact that is pretty discernible by many American workers at this point, They believed this was their path to victory. In the Pennsylvania 18th, the ads promoting that tax cut were yanked off the air when it became clear they were not working against Connor Lamb, and they went with more incendiary stuff about he was going to allow illegal aliens into all this stuff. Is it possible that the tax cuts are not going to have the impact that Republicans are hoping they will?
Well, I think you kind of put your finger on it. They are discernible, but they're not exactly a game changer. I don't want to get into a Nancy Pelosi argument, but you know, if you give me and if you do give me $1,000, I will be forever grateful. But it's not going to change how I live. It's not going to pay off my mortgage. It may help me cover maybe a half payment on a new car. But it's not going to change my point of view of how the world has changed. The other part of that, now, you do have people down here making a hard sell. I mean, Herman Cain was at the state capitol today in front of the state Senate trying to sell the enterprise zones that the Trump tax cuts include. But that gets into the details that really don't shape a voter's decision.
It doesn't surprise me, Bill, that the tax cuts themselves are not selling well, particularly in that district. So I want to take that district out of it. You know, James Carville was correct 20-plus years ago when he said, is the economy stupid? It's really about the economy and jobs. Mm-hmm. And so if Republicans are able to claim that the economy's better and people are getting jobs, that's the message that Republicans ought to be talking about. Because tax cuts, the people who got them kind of felt like that was going to happen anyway. It's not prospective. What are you going to do next is what the message should have been about the economy and getting more jobs out there. So I do think that there's some nuance to that. And what's in jeopardy for the Republicans is for the last 3 or 4 weeks, the stock market's been gyrating because of economic uncertainty.
The tariffs.
And the White House has injected that uncertainty. So for 18 months, we had certainty, less regulation, lower taxes. Now we're getting economic uncertainty for the first time, and I think that could jeopardize Republican messaging more than anything else.
If you start to see a place like Kia starting to retract its worst workforce based on the steel tariffs or the impact of the steel tariffs, then that bodes ill. That undoes everything that the Republican tax cut did in December.
Yeah. I think that's right.
These are really short term. Wins that they think the Republicans were trying to pick up on this. At the same time, when you have major retailers that are closing doors. So $1,000, $1,200, $800 is what compared to when I'm losing my job, right? So, you know, big box stores, you know, Payless, JCPenney's, Macy's.
Toys R Us.
Toys R Us now. You know, all these stores, Kmart and Sears have closed 150 stores. You know, we saw Sam's Club. So the idea of that, you're talking about a tax, you know, tax break when I'm losing my job or someone I know is losing my job is a total different category when it comes to benefiting how you live.
So, Heath, you're a Republican strategist. What would you tell Karen Handel in the 6th and Rob Woodall in the 7th about when they're giving their talking points, their speeches, what do they say about the tax cut and how important do they make it as a part of their campaign?
I think that a race like that, any kind of competitive race, it's all about kitchen table issues, right? And so if they're talking about it in the context of growing the economy, the number of jobs, new people coming back into the workforce, that's what Republicans ought to be touting as the end result of the economic activity of these tax cuts, not the tax cuts themselves. Tax cuts have become I win, you lose type of politics, whereas we had the largest jobs report in years. We had 800,000 people who quit looking for a job a couple years ago come back into the workforce in the last couple of months. There are some real positives out there. That's the Republican message. It does. If the folks who are losing their job at Toys R Us are picked up within 2 to 3 months, it won't hurt in November. The Republicans have a message there. If uncertainty continues and they don't find jobs, then they're going to have to alter their message.
All right. I want to turn to a race that isn't happening in Georgia. But in fact, Jim, this is, I think, so interesting. In Illinois, They have a well-contested attorney general's race. They have a couple of candidates on the Republican side. They've got, I think, maybe four on the Democratic side.
I think they've got eight.
Do they have that many?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting about that is what you would expect a candidate for attorney general to talk about is law and order, safety, you know, what some of the most basic issues in terms of...
consumer protection.
Yeah. Right. Okay. The Democratic candidates in Illinois are going in a different direction. And I want to play two of the ads. I'll play them each separately. This is the messaging coming from Democratic candidates for a state office in Illinois. Here's Renato Mariotti, Democratic candidate for AG.
Now we have a president who threatens nearly everything we hold dear. Our health care, our environment, even our constitutional rights as Americans. But we still have a legal system we can use to fight back. That's why I'm running for attorney general, so I can help us lead that fight. I didn't come from wealth like Donald Trump did. My dad's a cashier at Walmart. My mom answered phones for a local insurance agent. I fought many battles in my life, and I've already started taking on the Trump administration as a private citizen. So when he tries to undermine our health care or roll back environmental standards, my answer as Attorney General will be, we'll see you in court, Mr. President. So if you're angry, as I am, about a president who's disgracing our nation, please join our campaign for Attorney General.
So that's only one. There's another candidate, Jesse Ruiz. We have it. We won't play it right now. But they're running against Donald Trump for its Illinois Attorney General.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
only in that it is the mirror image of what we saw start to happen in 2008, and we've got the perfect man here to explain it. But in 2008, you saw Republican attorneys general mm-hmm. across the country start to unite and go after the Obama administration initiatives.
That's
and
right.
Now we are seeing the Democratic mirror image.
No, in two ways, right? Just as Barack Obama became the feature of every ad in every Republican primary in the country in 2009, 2010, and on, Donald Trump has become that lightning rod on the Democratic side. So it does not surprise me that they're all running against Donald Trump. What is interesting is because it's attorneys general, they're flipping the script. Republican AGs became the firewall in the fight against Obama's what we call federal overreach and actually successfully defeated the Obama administration in 7 out of 7 U.S. Supreme Court cases.
And Sam Owens was a big part of that, and Chris Carr has
continued
followed it.
Exactly. So now the Democrats have said, well, we're going to try to learn from what the Republicans did and see what we can do to fight the Trump administration. The difference is the Democrats are trying to force the federal government to keep doing things, not stop the federal government. I don't want to get too philosophical about that. There's some legal issues with that, but those are very effective ads, particularly in the Democratic primary, and we'll see more of it.
I think the reason you're seeing this is because it's been drilled home to lots of people that Trump has offended lots of people across the spectrum with personalized remarks, whether they're racist, whether they're attacks on people's character, that he has been the impetus of driving this home to people where they now feel it personally that they've been attacked. And so who else are they going to run against? They're going to run against the person who they feel are the spearhead or the vanguard at these personal type of attacks and policies against large parts of America. And that's why I think that's the key reason. I don't think it's directly comparable to Obama in the sense that there was a threat felt there, but more from a federal government overreach that you talk about. And I do believe that's the case. But with Trump, I think it's much more personal. And the fact that I think people felt like he's gone after certain sectors of the American population. And those people of that group feel like they actually have to try to do something.
All right, we've got to get another break out of the way. But when we come back, just a little tease for you. Your colleague, Jim Galloway, Greg Bluestein, just filed a really interesting story on the Political Insider blog about two candidates for governor, two Republican candidates, getting together and ganging up on the third in a news conference. Galloway is reaching for his iPad while we take this break.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times editor Jonathan Weissman tells us about becoming a target of neo-Nazi trolls on Twitter, who barraged him with anti-Semitic insults and threats. In his new book, Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump, he wrestles with how to respond to white nationalists and looks at connections between them and the Trump campaign and administration. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Heath Garrett, Michael Owens, Jim Galloway in the Political Rewind studio. A couple quick tweets. Cat and Mouse says, as a white liberal woman in rural Georgia, I'm 100% behind Stacey Abrams with her political experience combined with her forward-thinking plans for our children and workers. She's the only choice for me. That's interesting because that rural white vote is what Stacey Evans is hoping she can rekindle that old Yellow Dog Democrat coalition, or maybe she can. J.P. Cunningham says that, okay, here's how it is. Speaking objectively and from a distance, Trumpeters will drown in November due to the blue tsunami. We'll see how that goes forward. And Francie S. Johnson, Georgia 12 should be talked about. According to the Cook Report, it's as competitive as Georgia 6. Rick Allen has a rich primary opponent in Eugene Yu running to the right of Allen.
Yeah, he was in the field the first time Rick Allen was elected.
Yeah, so maybe I'll tell you what, we'll put that on the agenda to talk about on a show moving forward. So here's what he's your colleague. I'll let you, Jim Galloway, explain what Bluestein just reported, and it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, you don't have it wasn't their event, but you had two candidates for governor, both Republicans, show up at a state capitol event, and it's in support of HB 764, which would add PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, to the number of ailments that can be addressed through medical marijuana. You know that we've had a longstanding debate that was sparked by Alan Peake, who's going away this year, on medical marijuana. And Casey Cagle's just endorsed and I think set up a study commission, mm-hmm, on what to do about this issue, which is a delicate way of pushing it down the road, kicking the can a little bit until after November. Maybe we can come into some harder decisions on it.
Okay, it's going to be interesting. Teeth, how do you think this issue plays out with the Republican primary voters?
You know, I like to say this is a 2025, 2026 issue, really, in the Republican primary and in general elections, but it definitely is.
Wait, what do you mean? Far in the future?
I really think that we're still a couple of election cycles away from the Republican primary, this being a true wedge type issue. I do think it's going to have more influence in the general election, maybe in 2018, maybe more like 2020, 2022. But you'd have this growing libertarian influence on the Republican primary and on the general election in Georgia. And I think that these candidates are giving a tip of the hat to that. It's also trying to get some attention for the two candidates in last place primary.
Who I didn't mention, Clay Tippins and Michael Williams.
Right. And they're both in respectively, fifth and sixth place in the primary for right now, fourth or fifth place. And so they're trying to get some attention here. It will be attractive to a younger audience, which tends to skew towards more interest in this. For Clay Tippins, it has a little bit of the veterans, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, something that's been an issue of his as a former Navy SEAL. But not sure this is going to change the primary all that much, but it is a future-focusing issue.
Well, see, now what I would— opinion. Okay. Sure, of course it's your opinion, but what I would think, Michael, is if we're talking about a time frame that far in the future, we're not talking about medical marijuana. We're talking about Georgia. No, seriously, isn't the issue going to be recreational legalization?
Yes, I think from decriminalization all the way to recreation, and then all the economic impact and economic development that could come from it. At that point in time, I don't think it's about medical marijuana.
All right. Let me turn to a subject that you have expertise in here, as I mentioned at the very start of the show, Michael. It's a complicated story in some ways, but we learned from the New York Times this weekend, and actually it was fleshed out by a British newspaper as well, that the Trump campaign appears to have had some involvement with this group called Cambridge Analytica. Tell us about who Cambridge Analytica is, which I think Steve Bannon was instrumental in helping found, and what, given your expertise in the area of cybersecurity, what this story is about.
Sure. So Cambridge Analytica is a company, is a consulting firm that basically says they're a big data firm, right? And the basic gist around it is we can help you get to voters and market to them. What they were able to successfully do is harvest data from Facebook.
Let me interrupt if I can.
Sure.
Because they proposed, they made this pitch that they were going to be able to harvest vast amounts of data that the Trump campaign could use to win over voters.
Yes.
But then they realized they didn't know how they could get such massive amounts of data until somebody said, wow, we should scrape Facebook. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of the data. That's why I say, I mean, I hesitate when people say a data breach with the idea that someone broke into Facebook's internal database and stole information. What they were successfully able to do was harvest information that people were making available that was publicly available at the time. Now, it did break Facebook's terms of agreement and their policy around usage, which is where the heart of this problem is. But people have to understand, every time they click like on something or go to a specific page, that is being tracked by someone somewhere. Facebook, and I think this group, was able to gather 5,000 data points on around 230 million people. The voting population within the United States, I think, is 250 million people. So they have data, 5,000 data points, on almost every single voting age person in this country. That is just mind-boggling to even think about. But everything that you like, from a red cup to whether you like Apple or Android, every single thing that you've liked over this course of time, they've been able to build these psychological profiles of every single person. If you got 5,000 data points on anyone, you can get it. And you work in the realm of psychoanalytics, I'm sure you can build a profile on anyone about what their likes and dislikes are.
And you're directing advertising, you're directing articles, you're directing any kind of information.
When it came down to executing this, now once they gather all the information, they can be very precise and from a marketing standpoint, you know, kind of give you exactly what you want to hear. So this echo chamber kind of comes in. They know exactly what message to feed what people to further make them believe in that. So whether you want to go into the whole disinformation and fake news story or just go with whatever news is most appealable to those people, they were able to dial in almost laser focus and target the people they needed to with specific messages to ultimately help Donald Trump win this election.
So there's some really disturbing aspects of this.
It's tremendously disturbing. And I'll tell you what, Bill, before we went on air, you walked out of the studio here, and my two colleagues here, Heath Garrett and Michael Owens, started jawboning about what's to come next. And I want you guys to go there because it scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is almost, you know, dystopian for a lot of folks. First of all, a lot of people who've known better are shocked to find out today that Facebook was taking this information and selling it to people, when we in the political world and most people following Facebook know that's the business they're actually in, and that's how they become one of the wealthiest companies in the world, number one. Number two, it is amazing how much information these folks have been gathering. This didn't begin with Donald Trump's campaign in 2014 and 2015 with Cambridge Analytica. The Obama campaign used this exact same data to micro-target voters in 2012, and Republicans were screaming bloody murder then, because it sure looks like the Obama campaign got front-loaded data well before Republicans did. That didn't make the story. That doesn't make this any better, but it's absolutely scary how much power and how much information a couple of companies can have about every voter, and then sell it, and then have it potentially misused.
Yeah, when I worked in specifically in cybersecurity and cybercrime element of it, I really started to become more aware of how disinformation can be used to disrupt many other things. In this case, potentially campaign elections. Whenever technology is at the point, I think, Jim, video, right. We were talking specifically about how disinformation can come in, and now between artificial intelligence and machine code language, you now have the ability to manipulate what your own eyes see. So there's new technology out there now that enable you to have so many data points on a person in their face that you can literally be watching someone in a manipulated video saying something that they did not say. You could literally type something in Notepad, put it into an application, and make that person say it. To where now, if Jim, as the trusted reporter that he is, can look at a video and see someone saying something, and that is literally not what they said, that was misinformation or disinformation, and now to be validated and kind of taken from there by a reputable reporter, is going to make this much harder down the road to determine what's the quintessential real news versus fake news.
All right. Yeah. And that technology, as you pointed out, this is already available and it can be used at any moment. A couple of quick things about Cambridge Analytica, though, Jim. First of all, one of the troubling things about this is, and we'll see more reporting on this in the days ahead, is there is a Russian connection here. And, you know, this once again ties the Trump campaign, however tangentially, however innocently, however you want to describe it, here's another connection between Trump campaign and Russians.
And another target for Robert Mueller.
Yeah.
You have to know that he's looking at this.
Yes. We should also point out that this whole thing was paid for by Robert Mercer, who is a very wealthy Trump supporter and backer. So this is a big story that's not going to go away anytime soon. Finally, we don't have much time for it, but Heath, you must have been just thrilled to open Twitter over the weekend and see that the President of the United States was added again, this time calling Robert Mueller a liar, calling Anthony McCabe a liar, and for the first time directly challenging Robert Mueller's authority and honesty in dealing with this investigation. Does this help Republicans?
Look, anytime you have a kind of investigation like this, it doesn't help anybody.
Well, what about the tweeting?
And then the president is being true to his form, as he has always been, when faced with litigation in business, as a media personality, now as president of the United States, his first reaction is to fight back, scorched earth, you know, discredit his adversaries, and he is continuing that. It will not be helpful in some competitive races politically if you want pure political analysis. But the question becomes, eventually, Mueller's got to come forward with something, because right now it's been nothing. And in that vacuum, Trump is winning about half of the vote on this, because it sure appears like it's now an investigation not about what it was originally designed to find, but about other one-off things.
All right. We're out of time. Heath Garrett wins the microwave oven. He wins the microwave oven for getting the last line words in on today's show. We'll talk more about the president and the Robert Mueller investigation in the days ahead. And remember, they got to pass a spending bill by the end of the week. What fun. That's it for us from Political Rewind. We'll be back here again on Wednesday. I'm Bill Nygut. See you then.